ports of the United States were open, and the saboteurs were being tried by a military commission. If the precedent were applied, it seemed possible the trial had been unconstitutional. Biddle himself, who had dreamt up the prosecution's strategy, thought the Milligan case was troublesome and seemed to stand in our way. But the Supreme Court of 1942 gave scant attention to the precedent. Worried that Roosevelt might order the execution of the saboteurs before it even issued a ruling, the court reconvened on July 31st, 2 days after hearing argument. It announced in a single, unanimous order that the military commission had the authority to try the saboteurs. No opinion was issued to explain the order. Instead, the court promised that it would issue an opinion explaining its decision sometime in the future. Its immediate task accomplished, the Supreme Court resumed its vacation. A few days later, the military commission found all 8 infiltrators guilty and sentenced all of them to death by electrocution. When it came to Dosh, who had turned in the others on the expectation that he would go free, the commission recommended commutation to a sentence of 30 years. His associate Berger, who had agreed to help him, was recommended for life in prison. Roosevelt took the recommendations, turning down the infiltrators' pleas for clemency. On August 8th, less than 2 months after they had landed, 6 of the 8 men were executed, including 22-year-old Herbie Haupt, one of the 2 U.S. citizens. Dosh and Berger remained in prison only until 1948, when President Truman pardoned them and deported them to Germany. For the justices, writing the promised opinion justifying the military commission turned out to be more difficult than anticipated. Chief Justice Stone was able to convince himself and his colleagues that the saboteurs were unlike the defendants in Ex Parte Milligan because they were soldiers, while Milligan had been a civilian. According to this theory, the saboteurs' true crime was crossing enemy lines without a uniform, a violation of the laws of war. But there were other legal difficulties that could not be circumvented so easily. The Special Military Commission had not followed the rules laid out in the Articles of War passed by Congress. Roosevelt had ordered the verdict delivered to himself for review, not to the Judge Advocate General. And Roosevelt's initial order had also included the striking statement that no court would have the authority to review the commission's verdict. In principle, all the justices wanted to issue a unanimous opinion. After all, the entire goal of legitimizing Roosevelt's decision could be undercut if there were to be a dissent. What was more, the court had acted in a highly unusual fashion by its summary approval of the commission, and the court itself might be embarrassed if it turned out that there were good reasons to doubt the constitutionality of the trial now that the defendants had been executed. Behind the scenes, the justices began to squabble over Roosevelt's failure to follow the rules set out by Congress, as well as the question of whether he could tell the courts that they had no right at all to hear the saboteurs' case. On one side, Hugo Black was inclined to think that Roosevelt had overstepped his bounds in ignoring the Articles of War laid down by Congress. Congress, not the president, had the constitutional power to declare war. For Black, it followed that Congress could tell the president how to conduct that war, including how he might conduct military commissions within it. Black's preference for a close textual reading of the Constitution supported this perspective. Although Black did not then know it, further research would have revealed that at least some of the framers of the Constitution shared this rather formalistic view of the distribution of wartime powers. On the other side of the issue was Jackson, fresh from his job as Attorney General. While serving Roosevelt, Jackson had made history by arguing for broad presidential power. Now, consistent with that perspective, Jackson circulated to his colleagues a proposed concurring opinion of his own. In it, he maintained that the Supreme Court had no business reviewing any aspect of Roosevelt's decision on what to do with the saboteurs. His basis was not so much constitutional doctrine as practical necessity. Experience shows the judicial system is ill-adapted to deal with matters in which we must present a united front to a foreign foe. To Jackson, allowing the Supreme Court to sit in judgment of the president's actions during war was an unreasonable interference in operations crucial to the national defense. Far from seeing, as Black did, a president subordinated to the will of Congress, the pragmatic Jackson saw a president who sometimes had to act outside of ordinary legal bounds under wartime conditions. For both Black and Jackson, the backroom wrangling over the opinion in the saboteur's case offered a dry run for what would become their more fully developed views of presidential power, views that were in each case consistent with their broader beliefs about how to interpret the Constitution. As it turned out, neither published an opinion in the case. Along with the other members of the court, both were convinced by Frankfurter. In this secret debate among the members of the court, it was Frankfurter's own constitutional philosophy, the theory of judicial restraint, that would prevail. Frankfurter's ability to convince the other justices was occasioned by their collective fear of losing unanimity. As it became increasingly clear that it would be difficult for the court to issue a single opinion, justifying its earlier order to let the executions go forward, Frankfurter produced a strange memorandum that he sent around to his colleagues. It took the form of an imaginary dialogue between Frankfurter and the saboteurs themselves. In it, he excoriated the Germans in harsh terms, emphasizing that they deserve no rights and no consideration whatever from the court or indeed the United States. But the crucial passage, which Frankfurter's entire document was designed to emphasize, charged the saboteurs with the rather outré allegation that they were sowing dissension between the branches of government. "You've done enough mischief already without leaving the seeds of a bitter conflict involving the president, the courts, and Congress." Then Frankfurter delivered his judicial restraint punchline. "It is a wise requirement of courts not to get into needless rows with the other branches of the government by talking about things that need not be talked about if a case can be disposed of with intellectual self-respect on grounds that do not raise such rows." Almost any case can be disposed of on non-constitutional grounds. Whether this can be accomplished with intellectual self-respect, however, is in the eye of the beholder. In any event, following Frankfurter's circulation, the justices agreed not to make their differences public. Stone's opinion for the court simply ducked the issues of whether Roosevelt had to follow the Articles of War, and whether he had the power to put a case like the saboteurs beyond judicial review. When pressed, the court had shown wartime loyalty to Roosevelt, loyalty that would again become crucial in 1943, when the first cases about Japanese-American internment came before the court. Frankfurter could still function as a leader of the Roosevelt court, swaying his colleagues to the national cause and the man who led it. Chapter 24, Faith. In the spring of 1943, with the war raging in Europe and the Pacific, Felix Frankfurter found himself delivering an impassioned lecture to his colleagues in the privacy of the Supreme Court's